Chris Harrington of the Daily Memphian joins me to talk about Ja Morant's scorching return, the still bright future of the Grizzlies, and where to eat when you're in Memphis. All that and more is coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. You build on failure. Use it as a stepping stone. You close the door on the past. You don't try to forget the mistakes, but you don't dwell on it. You don't let it have any of your energy or your time or your space. Ja Gennaro, count me in! Today's first words belong to Johnny Cash, the man in black, a guy who knew a thing or two about Memphis, Tennessee, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get rolling, here are three things that I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to talk about the NBA into this microphone and to write about it. Pretty good deal. Number two, not only have I fully replenished my health bar after the stomach bug that caused me to miss last week's episode, but I'm feeling exceptionally ready to cook after spending some restorative holiday time with friends and family, as I hope that you all have as well. And number three, I get to spend part of my morning with somebody who's been one of my favorite NBA writers and thinkers for a long, long time. My guest today is an award-winning culture writer, critic, and basketball reporter whose work has appeared in the Memphis Commercial Appeal, the Memphis Flyer, and True Hoop, among other publications. These days, he is a columnist for the Daily Memphian, where he covers with great love and in great detail all aspects of the American jewel that is the city of Memphis, its music, movies, food, civic culture, and, most relevant for our purposes, its professional basketball team. Friends, a warm welcome for Chris Harrington. Chris, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Dan, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to be talking to you, going the other way, to be the guest instead of the host this time. I have to thank you for your unknowing but serendipitous Johnny Cash intro. I am actually distantly related to Johnny Cash. My great-grandmother, who died when I was in middle school, so I knew her growing up, she was Clara Cash of Kingsland, Arkansas. Southern Arkansas. She knew the Cash family. She was around them, part of that, you know, that extended family before they moved north to Dyess, Arkansas, when Johnny Cash was a small child. And so Johnny Cash had no idea who I was. His children had no idea who I was. But I know that I'm something like, I don't know, an eighth cousin or something like that to Johnny Cash.
Well, to me, Chris, that makes you royalty, and I am extremely excited for the serendipity of that moment. Chris, I've asked you here today not only because, unbeknownst to me, you are country music royalty adjacent. But because I think that you are as good as it gets on the Memphis Grizzlies and a team that has long been near and dear to my heart. And man, the boys in Beale Street Blue find themselves in the same kind of spot that our pal Johnny was talking about up top, needing to build on failure, needing to use it as a stepping stone and go somewhere new. So I wanted to talk about it. Could think of nobody that I'd rather talk about it with than you. And we'll get into that. But first, here on Divine Intervention, we always try to operate from a place of joy. So, Chris Harrington, what is something from the world of basketball that has brought you joy this week?
Well, obviously, the timing of that is sort of a Ja Morant-style alley-oop pass for me to talk about the return of Ja. But since we're going to talk about the Grizzlies mostly in the show, I'll pivot to a different place. And I know they lost their most recent game since we recorded. They lost last night to the Oklahoma City Thunder. But I have to give a shout-out to sort of my other team, the Minnesota Timberwolves. I went to college in the Twin Cities. I was there. I was there, LCD sound system voice. I was there for the Andres Gebert and Gundarz Vetra years. I was there for the Big Bear Bob McCann. I was there for the Isaiah Ryder, Christian Laettner crack up. I was literally there in Target Center as a college student the first game after Tom Gugliotta became the first ever franchise all-star for the Minnesota Timberwolves. So I've been a Wolves fan, mostly a former Wolves fan at this point, but I sort of cut my teeth as a Wolves fan. And so to see them first place in the West after Christmas, it's pretty great. I still have a lot of Twin Cities connections. I feel great for all my Wolves fans up there, for the team they have. And it's extra fun for me to see them get to this place with truly important contributions from two of my all-time favorite Memphis Grizzlies, Mike Conley and Kyle Anderson. So shout out to the Minnesota Timberwolves.
Absolutely. And I've been really enjoying these last few games where it's like, oh, Chris Finch is trying to figure out how to adjust the spacing on the court. It's like,
take Kyle Anderson out of the corner and give him the ball. He's a better point guard than he is a floor spacer over there.
Essential. Yeah.
You're going to figure it out. And also, yeah, like when in doubt, slap some slow-mo on it. Like he's going to figure it out on the ball, off the ball, whatever. Time for a ruthless plug. You say we're talking about alley-oop passes and you just set me up for one. I just wrote extensively long about the Wolves defense and about their how they've sort of come alive and come up. The numbers aren't up to date, but the general vibe of it is. So go to yahoosports.com. You can find my thing on the Timberwolves there. We're going to come back to them later. I have a couple of questions about them. But as you mentioned, we are going to speak first and foremost and primarily about these Memphis Grizzlies, these fighting Memphis Grizzlies, and these suddenly red hot Memphis Grizzlies. Before we get to the specifics of the turnaround, it has been a hell of a last 10 months for this franchise, and you've been up close and personal for all of it. Things falling apart with Ja Morant, the Dylan Brooks imbroglio, the trades and the fights, and a heck of a lot of losses. And just wondering from where you've been sitting, what's been the most frustrating part of the experience these last few months? Is it like people outside of Memphis kind of getting it wrong? Is it watching the team not be able to figure it out? What's been frustrating as you've been sitting front and center watching it?
Well, I think the two things that have hurt the most have been the Ja Morant thing and the Steven Adams thing. And they're both frustrating in different ways. I mean, the Ja Morant stuff is self-inflicted. You could argue about whether 25 games was too much or whatever, but like he earned his suspension. And then the Steven Adams thing, injuries happen, but the uncertainty around that, whether he would return in season, the organizational belief that he was going to be back this season and then for him to sort of exit like on the eve of the season. I think Adams was extraordinarily important, has been extraordinarily important for the Grizzlies' success the last couple of years. And so those two things are sort of a double whammy because the sort of fulcrum of their offense has been that Ja Morant, Steven Adams interaction. And so for both of those things to go poof, but really the past year has been like this year-long detour. I mean, this was a team that 2 years ago won 56 games, was the youngest playoff team in a basketball generation, I think, since the Durant, Harden, Westbrook Thunder. And if you go back exactly 1 year from the date of Ja Morant's return, his return is December 19th, 2023. He's returned from suspension. Go back 1 year, December 19th, 2022, Grizzlies were first in the West. They were half game up on the Denver Nuggets. Morant was on his way to a second All-NBA season, headed to a Supermax. That team was right back, you know, second in the West 2 years in a row. They were in first. And then the troubles came. And it started with Adams and Morant. It was Adams' knee injury, I believe, at Phoenix. And then the Morant stuff started percolating. It started percolating before the March game in Denver. It started, you know, there were things that were already happening that were starting to get reported. There was the incident in Memphis against the Pacers where one of Morant's friends got in a weird on-court sort of near altercation with Pacers players, and then another one after the game in the parking garage. And then it sort of fell apart, and there was a year-long descent from that, first in the West, to a 6-19 start. And now it's the climb back. And the climb back, it's no guarantee they're going to get all the way back to where they were a year ago. If they do, it might take another year. Because you're starting from 6-19 this season. But man, they're off to a good start and a tantalizing start in these four games since Ja's come back.
Absolutely. And we're going to get to that in just a second. But about the Ja comeback, I think one of the more interesting things to me about the way that this has been discussed, and again, you know, that I'm aware that there's a difference in how it's discussed locally and how it's discussed nationally, but there's this sort of like push and pull about like what this story is. Like, is it a redemption story? Is it a rebirth story? Is it about, you know, like a young guy who narrowly missed, you know, dangerous paths or whatever? You know, like what are we sort of talking about when we talk about Ja Morant? And you have seen, you know, every step in his journey since he came to Memphis out of Murray State. I'm wondering, like, he seems like a particularly fraught person. Like, so there's so much emotional connection to him. What does he represent in Memphis? Like, what has he meant to the city? And why does that feel a little bit different than other Grizzlies we've seen in the past?
Yeah, I mean, he's a different magnitude of player than they've ever had before. As good as Marc Gasol and Zach Randolph were, they were not quite, and Marc Gasol made first team All-NBA, something Ja Morant has not done. But Ja Morant as a young star, which neither of those guys quite were at their peak, and B as
even when they were young, they were kind of old.
Yeah. And I mean, Marc Gasol was 23 when he got to the NBA. Ja Morant already had two 47-point playoff games before he turned 23. And so Morant, as an on-ball offensive engine, is a different kind of is the kind of player who elevates a team in a different way. He's a level of star, obviously, that those guys weren't in terms of the highlights he generates, in terms of the interest he generates, you know, has his own Nike shoe, has his own thing. It's just a different kind of thing. But with Morant, I think there was also a sense that as, you know, frankly, a young black star in a majority black city, that he sort of represented the city and the culture of the city in a different kind of way, that a guy who was from the South, from the small town South in South Carolina, went to Murray State. So he had this element of sort of youth and flash and flair that I think the city related to, but also came from the kind of humble chip on your shoulder, small town, small college background that I think the city also relates to. And to put those things together in one package seemed to make him, like if you were going to draw up an NBA superstar for the city of Memphis on a blackboard, that's kind of what you'd come up with, that you get right. both in one package. And he sort of represented that. And so I think his fall, to the degree it's been a fall, and it has been painful for the city and for the fan base to watch that happen. But there's definitely, I think there are people out there who will say, like, what did Ja do wrong? You get some of that. But that's mostly sure. not the reaction. Mostly the reaction is that, you know, Ja messed up, but, you know, we're going to rally around our guy and pick him up, and we're going to be with him on the way back up. And that's kind of been more the general attitude of the city. And so I think, you know, Memphis has Ja's back, but Memphis, for the most part, understands that Ja has messed up, and Ja has brought most of this on himself.
And thus far, you know, the public comments after, you know, that initial press conference before that return game in New Orleans, and obviously the performance has spoken for itself. It seems like there's at least a conscious effort to kind of like, let's make sure we're rebuilding this in the right direction, like saying the right things, showing that actions matter more than words. And we understand that. And the way I get everybody back, it seems, is by A, balling out, and B, bringing back that sense of joy that had so suffused Memphis Grizzlies basketball for the last couple of seasons and was so absent for much of those first 25 games.
Well, I think what's been notable, and I know his dad, Ja's dad, T. Morant, had a couple quotes on like a radio show about, you know, comparing Ja's problems to some other problems in the league that haven't, you know, that maybe more actually legally questionable.
Sure.
But for the most part, that has not been the attitude, and that has not been Ja's public attitude about it.
Right.
That has not been the organization's. The organization didn't come out and say and protest the NBA's treatment. The organization was with the league on it. Ja Morant has not come out and said, I was wrong. Ja Morant has come out and said, you know, he's basically acted like he and Adam Silver are pen pals now, and like they're going to work together going forward. And I think there's been an awareness that Ja was having issues off the floor beyond just these two Instagram videos, and that there was an awareness, I think, from the NBA and from the Grizzlies and from Morant to a large degree, thankfully, that he needed to get his career and life back on track, and that what the NBA did was partly punishment, but it was as much intervention. It was a we value you as a young sort of institution in this league, and we need you to get your career and yourself back on track. It's important to the league, it's important to the organization, and it's important to you and your family. And I think, you know, whatever chippiness some fans have had about Ja's treatment by the league, Ja has not himself expressed that very much at all. In fact, when he had his return press conference in Memphis, to me, the most interesting thing he said mostly things you expected to hear. But what did he say you didn't expect to hear? Someone asked him if he'd made mistakes, and his response was, I've made mistakes you don't even know about. I've made mistakes with my family. And that is not something he needed to say. And right. So I think the fact that he has taken on that and acknowledged that, and yet has still come back with the kind of swagger and defiance on the court that helps make him great, I think it's been a good combination. We're four games in, but it's off to a good start.
Yeah, listen, we live in small sample sizes as we talk about these things week to week, day to day. And this small sample size that we are living in right now has been one hell of an uptick for the Memphis Grizzlies. I think if your first question was like, when Ja comes back, which Ja are we getting? The answer is he's still freaking Ja Morant. And I'm wondering, so again, you covered those first, you know, the first 25 games, the 6-19 and all the, did you like have whiplash going from what you watched for the first couple of months to what it was like when, you know, pretty much right away, that first game in New Orleans?
It was, yeah. And it was, it's been a reminder of not only how good Morant is, and I think that maybe has been forgotten just a little bit because so many other young guards have been so great in his absence. And part of this story from Ja Morant, from a personal standpoint, is climbing his way back up the charts a little bit among the league's great young players. Because in his absence, like, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is popping off, and Tyrese Halliburton's popping off, and De'Aaron Fox, and Tyrese Maxey, and all these great young guards. And he gets to rejoin the fray in terms of competing with those guys, which he had Halliburton in his first home game back. He's going to get De'Aaron Fox on New Year's Eve, right? This is part of the fun of it all. But it was a reminder of not only how good he is, but kind of impact he has. He is one of these guys who sort of is an offense unto himself a little bit. And so you look at the Grizzlies in the first 25 games and the Grizzlies in the four games since he's been back. This was a team that over the last two or three years was in the top three basically every year with Morant and points in the paint and fast break points. The first 25 games, they were like 25th, 26th, 27th in those categories. In the four games he's been back, they're instantly back at the top five rate in those categories. You know, they were dead last in offense in the NBA the first 25 games. In the four games since he's been back, if you take that number and apply it to the season, it's like 12th or 13th. He instantly turned them by himself back into an above-average NBA offense from the worst in the league and instantly changed the style of play from a team that had no pop to a team that's right back, attacking the paint, getting to the rim, getting out in transition. He did all that instantly. You know, he suddenly made Zaire Williams playable again. He suddenly made Xavier Tillman playable again. Suddenly bench units with him and four bench guys were like working because he could make it work. And it's been a little bit of a reminder about the sort of the catalytic impact he can have on a team offensively. That he is one of these guys, and there are plenty others, but it's still like not that long of a list. But he is one of these guys who can by himself as a combination scorer and creator be a team's offense, really.
And to put some numbers to that, because the numbers bear repeating or bear some mentioning, first four games back for Ja Morant, 28.8 points per game, 8.5 assists a game, 5.3 rebounds a game. He's shooting 67% in the restricted area, 63% from floater range. You know, all the talk about the Grizzlies being team floater for years and years. And a lot of that was just based on his ability to get 2 feet in the paint and go up from, you know, right, you know, just inside the free throw line and nail that. He's been a huge clutch performer for a team that had struggled offensively in all four quarters, but in the fourth quarter, notably, right, had the game winner over the Pelicans in the first game, had 11 points between the fourth quarter and overtime in another come from behind win over New Orleans on Tuesday night, which was attended by some chaos in the latter part of that game with a lot of fouls and reviews and Jonas Valanciunas fouling on an alley-oop with 0.4 seconds left, all sorts of stuff. So, you know, underline it all, though, and it's Grizzlies win, rather, 31 points in 37 fourth quarter minutes for Ja Morant since he came back. He has absolutely, as you said, it has transformed. Like, the Grizzlies were never have not been a great half court offensive team, period. But right, it was Ja getting into the paint, that rim pressure, being able to generate just enough openings for other people to be able to do that. And the difference between dead last in the league and like 20th in the league in a half court offense, and then from bottom five in the league to top 10, top five transition offense, that's the difference. That's the whole ball game, with the exception of the offensive rebounding piece, which you mentioned Steven Adams earlier, but right, even that has taken a notable uptick these first few games, just because by virtue of him getting into the paint and getting the ball on the rim so that there are more of those opportunities and more chaos in the paint, more bodies down there, more congestion and more opportunities for the Grizzlies front court guys to go get it. And it's just, it had the value of, as you mentioned, an offense unto himself it's been, you know, very, very clear, very, very quickly. And he looks like he has not missed a beat at all. But as we move from the period of his suspension and his absence to, you know, now whatever this new team is going to wind up looking like, I'm wondering, from that first 25 games, because obviously, as you mentioned, the Grizzlies put themselves in a gigantic hole and are going to spend the rest of the season trying to climb out of it. But I'm wondering, what from that first 25 games do you think matters? Like, what is there anything from that early part of the season that the Grizzlies can take and say, like, that is actually something we need? It is of value for us as we try to climb out of that hole, as we figure out what's next.
I think you start with Desmond Bane's elevation. As much as the team was struggling offensively, it was not because of him, right? Desmond Bane took on more of a burden as a lead guard in terms of his usage, in terms of his playmaking, in terms of his scoring. And the story of Desmond Bane from his rookie year has not been getting better as much as taking on more without getting worse. Year after year after year, takes on more shots, more usage, and the efficiency holds. And I think when you look at what he was able to do, the way he and Jared Jackson took a big step forward, at least offensively. Defensively, he's been good, but not the force he was the past two seasons. But his scoring has jumped up like 4 points a game. And so those guys, that's the one and two, weren't good enough to carry a team that I think the issues were really like what was going on around them. I think the bottom third, maybe the bottom half of the Grizzlies roster got exposed in these first 25 games because not only was it no Morant, no Adams, no Brandon Clark, mostly no Luke Kennard, mostly no Marcus Smart, and the back half of the roster got exposed. It's just not good enough, even to be the back half of a roster. But what Bane and Jaren did, I think the most encouraging thing about these four games since Ja's been back for the Grizzlies, not just for the rest of this season, but I think even more importantly, projecting into next season, is what these three players are doing together. Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, and Jaren Jackson. You threw the Ja stats out there in the four games he's been back. Ja's not the leading scorer for the Grizzlies over these four games. Desmond Bane is. Desmond Bane
That's
is
a
averaging.
Great number.
Yeah, Desmond Bane's averaging 29, 5, and 6 since Ja Morant's been back. And so he is not taking a step back. He's maintained. And what they've been able to do, because Desmond Bane can operate as a lead guard much more effectively now, they stagger them. So I don't think there's been a minute on the floor in these four games without one of those two guys out there. And when Ja goes to the bench, the backup point guard is Desmond Bane. Desmond Bane is running the team when Ja's on the bench. So they have one of those two guys on the floor for all 48 minutes. Jaren Jackson settling into like the third option. These four games, he's averaging 21 points a game on 66% shooting. That's the third option. They are 1 point away. 1 point. He had 19. Jaren Jackson last night in New Orleans. They are one Jaren Jackson point away from all three of those players averaging scoring 20 or more points each in all four games. And that happened once last season. There was one game last season where Ja, Dez, and Jaren all scored 20 in a game. It's happened three times in four chances, and they were 1 point away from 4-4. The Grizzlies' all-time record is 7-0 when those three players score 20. And so I think the good news for the Grizzlies, even at the 6-19 start, and I made this point a lot locally, and maybe it sounded Pollyannish, but I think it was true, is that the Grizzlies weren't a great place for a 6-19 team, because they were a 6-19 team that had Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, and Jaren Jackson all under contract together for two more seasons after this one, all in their still in their early to mid 20s. And if you look at a list like, you know, our friends at The Ringer, they put out their player rank thing a couple months ago. You could argue the rankings, and I think they'd Rudy Gobert too low, so it's not necessarily my rankings. But by that measure,
I imagine that's not the first thing most people argued about, was whether or not Rudy Gobert was too low.
Well, they had Jaren Jackson ahead of Rudy. And for right now today, I would not do that. But there were two NBA teams that had three players in the top 40 on that list. One was the Boston Celtics. The other was the Memphis Grizzlies, who started 6-19 this season. And so whatever problems have been exposed in the rest of the roster, and I think some pretty serious problems have been exposed in the rest of the roster, they got Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, and Jaren Jackson, like all under contract, not only this season, but for two more after this. And that's a really strong place for a franchise to be.
To your Desmond Bane point, which is a fantastic one, and you wrote a great column about this, as like Desmond Bane being the silver lining in an otherwise sort of gray cloud of a start. That point about being able to do more without doing it worse, it sounds like a very elemental thing, but that is not the way the usage efficiency curve typically works for NBA players. The more you got to do, the harder it is to do it well. And so doing more and more and maintaining is like, That is a gigantic, sort of boulder to hold on your shoulders. And for him to be able to do it at the minutes load he was, at the efficiency he was sensational. And if you make his job easier by bringing another primary playmaker at the level of Ja Morant, and, you know, the opportunities for that offense are, you know, really skyrocket. Bane, one of only 15 players in the league this season, averaging better than 25 points and 5 assists per game on an above league average true shooting percentage. So factoring in three-pointers are worth more than two, et cetera. And the list, that 15 guys, it's 11 guys who've made all NBA. Jalen Brunson, who might be making the case for that this year. Tyrese Maxey, almost certainly on his way to his first All-Star game. Anfernee Simons, which if anybody was paying attention to the Trailblazers, they'd see that he has absolutely exploded this season. And then it's Desmond Bane. So you're talking about those engine type guys. This is who Desmond Bane put himself in that company in that first, you know, quarter, a little more, a third of a season. And so now he gets to operate a little bit more and having somebody set more things up for him, not quite as much unassisted. And Jaren Jackson Jr. is one number that I love. It's because his game, his offensive game has been sort of, it's been built like brick by brick over the course of the year. Yeah. I don't mean that as, you know, metaphorically or as a, you know, derogatorily. But
as I've explained it over the years, he has been a bundle of attributes trying to put that together into a basketball player a little bit. That's sort of been the story of his career.
Absolutely. And so it starts with, you know, you have the general frame or shape of, you know, that's the unicorn guy. He's the floor spacing floor spacing stretch five. And then you add on the face up game and you add on some more, you know, pump and go driving and a little bit more handle from outside. This year, he is doing career best work out of the post. This is from Synergy Sports Technology, their stats, 1.15 points per possession finished out of the post. He's shooting 61% on post-ups. That is 12th best out of 48 players that have posted up at least 30 times. So, you know, the numbers above that, it's, you know, it's Kristaps Porzingis, it's Joel Embiid, it's DeMar DeRozan, it's some of these guys that are like it's Jokic, those sorts of players. And Jaren's not at that level of efficiency at this point, but he's better than he's ever been. And you add that to what he's added as a face-up, you know, dribble driver, what he does provide as a shooter that you got to at least honor out there, and the way that that can kind of add more space and more opportunity for that Grizzlies offense. If what we've seen is the floor for where they're going to be now that they've got Ja Morant back, the potential increase for them, the rise, the growth, you know, could get them back to being another, you know, league average caliber offense. And that plus the fact they've already been a top 10 defense, even through all these struggles, like,
yep,
that looks like the profile of, you know, a serious team. And you know, I wonder, you know, we've seen now Marcus Smart comes back last night, makes a huge impact on the defensive end, especially late in that game, the forcing the turnovers, the steals, specifically the steals that are like breaking up fast breaks. So that's like, that's not just a turnover, but it's a turnover that takes likely points away from the other guys. Stepping in for the charge on Zion, picking Brandon Ingram's pocket for the pick six going the other way. He's back. Luke Kennard, you know, maybe, you know, potentially following him pretty quickly. Ja back and what the, you know, that sort of core big three. What is a realistic, or how, not even realistic, how big do you think they get to dream now? Like, obviously, you know, it's 10-19. It's whatever, 4.5 games out of the play-in. It's still a long way to go. But how big do you think they get to dream now that they actually get to see the team?
I think they need to keep a focus on next season. I really do. I think what I said coming out of last season, this is before the renewed Ja Morant troubles and all of this, was, okay, you have a 3-year window and it's go time. You're going to have Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, Jaren Jackson all locked up once you extend Bane, which they were going to do. You're going to have them all locked up together for 3 more seasons. At that point, Jaren Jackson's up for a new contract, and who knows? Maybe you have them together for 10 more years. But you know you got them for 3. You got them for 3, entering their second contracts, entering their mid-20s. It is go time. You have to be all in for this 3-year window. Well, this year took a hit. You know, 6-19 is hard to come back from, and Steven Adams is not coming back. Brandon Clark probably not coming back. Maybe. We'll see. So do they have a chance to climb back up into the play-in this season? Yes. Could they be the 10 seed or the 9 seed teams look at and say, wait a minute, why are we playing this team, you know, in a play-in game or in a first-round series? Yes. They should want that. That's what they should strive to be. But the best season they're going to have is probably not going to be this season. It's probably good. It's not about, you know, the best case scenario this season is being the 10 or the 9 no one wants to play. They need to be focused on coming into next season with a team that's going to be a top 3 seed in the West again, that they think they can win a title with or compete for a title with, to get to a conference finals with, around that Ja, Jaren, Des core. So I think the tricky thing for the organization is to try to maximize this season as much as you can, but don't do anything that takes away from those next two, because those next two are set up better for you. And all that really means is don't trade any future picks for a rental, right? I think if they look to do things to improve this team this season, they should be looking for things that will carry over into next season and the year after. And so I think they have to keep an eye on that. They're not fully fixed right now. They have to evaluate what they need to do. What extent do they need to restructure this team around that Ja Morant, Desmond Bane, Jaren Jackson core to maximize it, not only for this season, but beyond. And part of that is like, do we think Steven Adams is coming back 100% pre-injury form next season? Do we think Brandon Clark's coming back 100% pre-injury form? You can't evaluate that stuff on the floor right now. You can't evaluate the rest. And they've gleaned a lot of information in these first, in the first 25 games, some of it quite negative on some of these guys. But I think the first thing you evaluate, and it's the guy you just talked about, is Marcus Smart. They've had one game of Marcus Smart playing with those other three, and it looked pretty good. It was everything they envisioned of Marcus Smart being able to start alongside Ja Morant and Desmond Bane. Marcus Smart making the hustle plays, the winning plays on both ends of the floor. Marcus Smart not having to take on a bunch of usage offensively, frankly. And I think the one thing that I think people outside of Memphis got most wrong about the Grizzlies this season, and it's understandable because the reality is counterintuitive, but I heard a lot of people say as they were struggling with that 6-19 start, you know, this Marcus Smart thing, they went out and got Marcus Smart because Ja was going to be out. They went out to get Marcus Smart to help them navigate Ja's absence. That is not why they went out and got Marcus Smart. If their overriding concern was the 25 games without Ja Morant, they may have just kept Tyus Jones and waited for the trade deadline to move him. They made the Marcus Smart addition not because of Morant's absence, but because of Morant's presence. What they liked best about Smart was not that he could help them navigate the point guard position for 25 games with Morant out. They wanted him playing with Morant. They wanted him with Morant off the floor, too. They wanted him with Morant on and off the floor. They wanted him for the locker room, for the infrastructure, the support structure around Ja. And they wanted him to play that Dylan Brooks role, which is you're the quote unquote small forward who can scale down and guard lead guards. And that is a key sort of function of the Grizzlies that Dylan Brooks gave them, was that they don't just need their ostensible small forward to be their best perimeter defender. They need that person to be able to defend point guards. Dylan Brooks was able to do that. And then you take burden off of Morant, right? You can go hide Morant somewhere else. You don't have to ask Desmond Bane to be your primary backcourt defender. So you've got this offensively powerful backcourt of Morant and Bane, but you need your small forward to scale down and guard Damian Lillard and guard Steph Curry and guard De'Aaron Fox and guard these guys. When they were losing Dylan Brooks, they needed to replace Dylan Brooks with someone who could play that role defensively. And Smart, they targeted Smart to do that. And the other thing that's worked out, I think, for them, and this is a little bit of a bet, but I believe in it, they found two of those guys now. Because they got a guy on a two-way named Vince Williams Jr. who can do that too. And so you have these three players of Morant, Bane, and Jackson, which is your foundation. And now I think they got two guys who can be great perimeter defensive role players with them in Marcus Smart and Vince Williams. And now you got to figure out the rest. But I think the most interesting thing right now is to watch Marcus Smart and Vince Williams Jr. and how they play those roles, sort of supplementing your core.
I am so glad you brought him up, because if you didn't, I was gonna. We talked about the challenges of the back half of the roster, right? And yep. you know, you look at it, you go back over the course of the past few off seasons, it's basically like an all-star second unit that has gone out the door. You know, Grayson Allen has started on playoff teams. De'Anthony Melton starting for a really good team in Philadelphia. Slo-Mo starting for a really good team, or not starting, but playing big minutes for a really good team in Minnesota. Dylan Brooks, you know, the Rockets defense suddenly skyrocketing. Tyus Jones, well, you know, everything can't work out exactly the way you want it to, but Tyus Jones, you know, certainly one of the highest level backup point guards in the league. That's a ton of second unit talent out the door the last few off seasons, and the backfill from the, you know, late lottery picks, you know, late first round picks, the, you know, undrafted guys, whatever, trying to sort of fill in all those spots. Hit and miss. You know, Santi Aldama has been a find and a legit player and somebody that they clearly trust and believe in, and who has, you know, validated that trust. But, you know, David Roddy can be hit and miss. Jake LaRavia, kind of a non-entity so far. Zaire Williams, you mentioned, you know, seems to need Ja Morant to make him playable. John Conchar is a guy who's been like less effective the more minutes he seems to get. Like, he has been, was a very efficient player in shorter minutes. And then, you know, more, you know, that's the usage efficiency curve the way it normally works, right? But then there's Vince Williams Jr. And two-way contract guy and has, you know, the way he looked, and maybe it's just because I've in the last couple of weeks we've seen it, or last week we've seen them play the Pelicans a couple of times, but I'm looking at him and I'm like, lefty, rangy, guards everybody. I'm like, tell me that that's not like them incubating their own Herb Jones. And maybe that's not the right comp, because I know in Memphis there's plenty of defense first grinder comps that you can go to over the years. But tell me what you have seen out of Vince Williams Jr. that makes you think maybe that guy's got a chance to be one of those backfill players, even though the contract situation becomes a little bit of a challenge with him on a two-way and them trying to figure out guaranteed spots.
Defense, rebounding, and activity, that kind of activity is more reliable night to night than whether shots fall or not. And so the second game at New Orleans, the one that's last night as we speak, was a typical Vince Williams game. He was 1-for-4 from the floor. He also, his 6'4 wing, had 8 rebounds and 3 assists and 3 blocks and a steal, and they won his minutes on the floor. And that's been pretty constant with him. And the guy he reminds me of, because a lot of people said, oh, this is who they wanted Dylan Brooks to be, you know, a guy who just defends everybody, doesn't care if he shoots. The guy he reminds me of is James Posey. They go really way back in the Grizzlies
day. I like that.
He's a little bit smaller, but he has the same sort of long-limbed, soft-spoken, which is opposite of Dylan Brooks in both regards. You know, he's this guy who has endless arms and is kind of quiet, but is really tough on the floor. He'll get in your face. He'll get in a star's face. He got in C.J. McCollum's face in the first game in New Orleans, Jaws return game. Like, he hit a 3 and just like right up in his face when they're down 20, you know? He's a guy who he can defend 1 through 3. He rebounds like crazy, which is a subtle, important thing for the Grizzlies. Jaren's not a good rebounder. They've had a lot of perimeter players. Dylan Brooks is not a good rebounder. They need perimeter players who will go get boards. And that's one of the things that's made Conchar sort of playable for the Grizzlies some, because he rebounds like crazy too. Vince Williams is like the better Conchar. Like, he's a longer, more athletic, but he's the same kind of guy who will knock down some open threes, he'll rebound like crazy, and he doesn't need a lot of shots. And I think what he's done defensively is 100% real. They need to elevate him off a two-way and get him on a real contract. But they basically threw a lot of darts in the same direction, and that's the one that hit. You know, they were throwing darts at role player wings to play with their core, low usage role player wings, right? And so Zaire Williams and Jake LaRavia and Conchar and Roddy. And it's the guy you took number 46 and stuck on a two-way when he finally got his opportunity. That's the one who has hit. And I think he has hit for real. I don't know if I believe in the three-point shooting. I don't know where the percentage will settle. It may just not settle, because sometimes that doesn't settle. But I think what he does defensively and as a rebounder, as just an energy role player, I think is very real. And I think I believe in that more than anyone else in the back half of the roster.
You mentioned Brandon Clark earlier, and somebody that was he was a widely loved pick coming out of Gonzaga, you know, as like, you know, end of the first round guy, where you're like, man, how did this guy get all the way down there? Because he can just come in and play. And he has been sort of integral to some of Memphis's best lineups over the last few years. When you get him and Jaren on the floor together, it's like the most mobile, quickest, most havoc wreaking-y version of that Grizzlies front court. And you're right. As you talk about these things sort of cascading all at one time, there was the Adams injury and then Jaws sort of trouble start. But that night in Denver, Brandon Clark ruptures his Achilles. And then that's when, you know, Jaws first Instagram live foray goes down.
Well, you talk about all the depth pieces that they lost, you know, they let go or they traded or that they lost. They knew they couldn't keep everybody, so the two guys they decided to commit to were Steven Adams and Brandon Clark. And they signed them both to multi-year contract extensions, and they both got massive injuries almost immediately after signing those extensions.
Yeah, you can't plan for that or budget for that necessarily, especially. And the argument made a ton of sense. It's, we are a team that is built on offensive rebounding and the way that we clear the board so that we can get Jaw out in transition, and that's like the fundamental parts of our offense or of our identity. And then you have two giant pieces that go out right away. Just wondering, because there's been some uncertainty about what, if any, timeline there is for Clark. I remember, I forget which game it was, but hearing, you know, the play-by-play guy first say out for the year, and then somebody say, well, actually, it's not clear that he's out for the year. Any sense of where that might be going, if they're expecting to just not have him at all this season, or if they're holding out some hope that maybe as we get past like a year from the injury date, there might be some opportunity for him to get back in the mix?
the Grizzlies have not declared Brandon Clark out for the year, unlike Steven Adams. He is not officially out for the year. When the injury happened in March, the suggestion at the time was he would probably be able to play late the following season, so late this season, which was no guarantee that the Grizzlies would play him, but he would maybe be eligible to return by the end of the season. He did have what the team calls a cleanup procedure over the summer, which that made a lot of people conclude, okay, well, he's definitely not coming back this year. Right. I sort of concluded that too, but the team has never officially said that. There was a story out of Ja's return game where I guess Mark Spears was able to talk to Brandon Clark, and Brandon Clark told him he was planning to come back at the All-Star break. I'll note that when Jaren Jackson had his knee injury and was out for a long time, it's good for Mark Spears and getting to talk to these injured players who are generally not made available. But when Jaren was out with a knee injury, there was also a story where he told Mark Spears he was going to be back for the MLK game. He came back 3 months after that. So I think sometimes these players see a best case scenario. I'm not expecting Brandon Clark back, you know, at the All-Star game or trade deadline or any of that. Maybe he reappears by the end of the season, but I wouldn't count on it. I think it's more likely he'll be back to start next season.
Kind of fascinating to find ourselves here. You know, I mentioned it last time when Josh Gondelman was on the show and we were talking about the Celtics, something my friend, your friend, Paul Flannery had mentioned a long time ago that the best time you can have in this league is right before you get real good. And then the Grizzlies got real good and then had the, you know, hammer of the gods kind of swung down on them for a little bit. You mentioned this year in the wilderness, and now they get to go back on the climb, and maybe this is the, you know, we get to have fun again. Maybe this is the watching and following of this team rebuild, trying to rebuild something. And yeah, there's this flaw and there's that flaw and there's this thing that isn't working quite right. And the roster doesn't necessarily have everything we need. But you know, now you get to be the hunter as opposed to the hunted. And maybe there's an opportunity for some extra joy here that we didn't and might not have anticipated as they were mired in the midst of the 6-19 start.
It's not the story arc fans would most want to have, but it's still a pretty compelling story arc. And so, yeah, it'll be an interesting thing to watch this attempt at sort of reclaiming the spot that they once had and that John once had.
Well, we're going to go through a couple more narratives here, but we're going to shift specifics away from the Memphis Grizzlies to a little game that we occasionally play on the show called Fill in the Blank. It's a really complicated game. I hope you're taking notes. I give you a couple of prompts and we play a game where you fill in the blank.
All right.
So let's start here. The best team that I've seen in person this season is?
Best player I've seen in person is Luka. The best team I've seen is either Boston or Minnesota. I know they're at the top of the standings, but I was struck by both the defensive infrastructure that those teams have. Both games I saw, I happened to see Rudy Gobert and Kristaps Porzingis get 6 blocks. And when you got these giants at the rim surrounded by the defensive talent on the perimeter they have around them, those defenses are rock solid, I think.
Yeah, I admittedly have not gotten out to too many games. I'm more of a couch boy at this point. But I will say the one that my answer to this would be the Bucks. I got to see them against the Nets early in the season. They put up 129 and it looked like they were still in like first gear. They were still had not figured out the Dame Giannis pick and roll yet. Middleton was still working his way back and they were still just absolutely overwhelming offensively. So, and then since I saw them, they've been the best offense in the NBA in a near top 10 D while still seeming like they're figuring it all out. So in terms of top end talent and walking away impressed, I'll go with them. You mentioned your Twin Cities bona fides earlier, and I'm going to bring it back to you. The Timberwolves are going to finish in blank place in the West.
Second. Denver will reclaim the top spot. Minnesota will finish second. I think, you know, that they're for real as a regular season team. I'm not sure about the postseason. But I think Denver wants, you know, if they have their core healthy for most of the second half, I think Denver will rise back up to first. I got Minnesota second.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, they both face one of among the softer go home schedules over the last, you know, 45 games or so of the season. And yeah, I think there's no reason not to bank on a healthy Denver with that starting five. And also some of the guys they've been able to bring along a little bit, you know, with Christian Brown and Julian Strother and some of the reserve guys that have Reggie Jackson, by the way, not washed, totally like actually helpful backup point guard in 2023 will wonders never cease. But yeah, to me, I think you're absolutely right to say that is the structure of what Minnesota has built makes sense, even though last year everybody was falling all over themselves to talk about why it didn't make sense. Actually, it worked out to where it does make sense. Because what if you plug the Rudy Gobert Jazz, but then like plug in actual wing defenders around it? Seems like a pretty reasonable thing to bet on. The coolest player in the NBA right now is...
I got to take an opportunity to give a shout out for one night only, the coolest player in the league was Dylan Brooks in his return game to the Grizzlies, which I got to cover and write about. My man comes into town, comes to shoot around, is as gracious as it can be. It's just great to be back home. I got to sleep in my own house here in Memphis. I've seen some new stuff in the city. That's great to see. I love it here. It means so much to me. He comes out for his warm-up routine before the game and then spends 20 minutes taking pictures, kissing babies, having warm conversations with former coworkers, you know, taking pictures with fans along the front row, comes out the second half and rips the heart out of the Grizzlies, hits a game-winning three right in front of the same fans he had been taking pictures with 2 hours before, and turns around and barks at them and heckles them, then goes back to the locker room, dresses all in black from head to toe, except for no undershirt. He's sitting there with Jeff Green in the visitor's locker room. He's got black jeans and black shoes, and he throws on a black jacket over his bare chest, and Jeff Green says, "Put a shirt on under that." And Dylan Brooks says, "Nah, man, I can't do that. I came home." And then he puts on a black balaclava and black sunglasses, funeral from head to toe, walks over, says, I put this outfit together just for this game, and proclaims he will never lose to the Grizzlies again. Shout out to Dylan Brooks.
Oh, man, I love every tip to tail. Every part of that is fantastic. This is, I know, and it'll get me in trouble sometimes, but I am a firmly pro Dylan Brooks person. This is a pro Dylan Brooks podcast. I am of the belief that with guys like that, they to get the 90% that you need, you have to get, you know, make peace with the 10% you don't like.
Right.
Because that 90% is something that nobody else in the world is going to give you. And Dylan Brooks, apparently that extends to the post-game fashion show as well. Yeah, you could not, I mean, and of course, Memphis, famed wrestling town, who loves a heel more than Memphis? And like for him to come back wearing the black hat, literally, you know, what a way to return to the territory for Dylan Brooks.
Well, this was my preview column theme. It was boo this man out of appreciation. How do you show a heel? How do you show proper appreciation to a heel? You boo the heel.
That's exactly right. And I can't top that. I'm just going to go Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. But all I will say, if Ja Morant has a few more weeks like the week he just had, he returns very quickly to the at or near the top of that rankings. I wrote once when I was at the Ringer, I wrote once that Ja leads the league in holy shit. And I continue to think that is he has earned his way back into the top of that rankings pretty quickly. The most disappointing thing in the NBA right now is?
It's hard not to say the Suns at the moment. Devin Booker was my preseason pick for MVP. I thought he was going to have a massive season.
That's gutsy. That's a pretty gutsy pick.
I was looking to go off the board at least a little bit. And I thought he was going to have a massive season as the clear-cut number one guy on that team, even with Durant there. I thought they were still going to be a top two or three team in the West, even with the structural problems of the rest of the roster. And I thought he was going to have a massive season. And he's still been very good, but it's just not working out for them right now. And I think they're in a little bit of trouble. So I'm going to go with Phoenix as most disappointing.
Unfortunately, Chris Harrington, you couldn't have known what the budget for The Ringer and Yahoo Sports was going to be, because you could not have known that Michael Pina and I were both going to write about how good Point Booker was, which is the Ringer curse combined with my individual curse. It's really just an overpowering combination and has laid them low. I mean, there's a point where you can say, like, the sober, heady analyst going, well, you know, I'm going to wait to worry about them until I see their whole team. And it's like, dog, it's 30 games into the season and we haven't seen the whole team yet. So at some point, it starts getting late kind of early. I think it is a completely reasonable pick, especially now that we've got, like, as everything turns into, you know, online culture eating itself. Is this Kevin Durant being failed? Does Kevin Durant need to be freed? Has Kevin Durant submarined another franchise? Is Kevin Durant worthy of the stands that he has? Whatever. All of this stuff seems to be like immolating itself, and that's not a great place to be for the Phoenix Suns. I'm going to go just as a to add on to it. The Raptors, again, being the same kind of generally like bad and not exciting, like pick a direction, guys, do something.
Yeah.
And if it's, you know, I'm not going to be saying like free Pascal Siakam or free OG Anunoby. Scottie Barnes has been awesome and deserves all the praise that he's gotten from, you know, people saying he deserves all-star consideration, even though that team has not been good. If you want to build around Scotty and OG and figure the rest of it out, I completely understand that. Just do something. You know, it's like poking you with a stick. Do something, Masai Ujiri and Bobby Webster. All right. We'll finish up the fill in the blank segment with this. The best nickname in the NBA is?
I don't know if this is the best nickname, but I'll take the opportunity to let you adjudicate something from the esoteric corners of Grizzly social media lately.
I appreciate that.
Vince Williams, who we talked about earlier, VW, the bug. How do we feel about the bug for Vince Williams?
I personally enjoy it. Maybe punch buggy is the way we could punch that up. You know, he does his damage. I wonder if it doesn't suggest that he's physically imposing as physically imposing as he is with those long arms, with that defensive activity. But anything that gets more people talking about this player and about a guy who came from, as you said, second round, two-way contract, whatever, get him a nickname, get him into the public consciousness. I'm all for the bug until we figure out something better that comes along. I don't have a real great answer here. Although Anthony Edwards calling Mike Conley bite and saying it's because he looks like he's about to bite somebody when Mike Conley is like the least about to bite somebody guy in the history of humanity, let alone the NBA. And then Rudy Gobert laughing about it because apparently that either is or sounds like the French term for penis. I mean, that's kind of interesting. But, you know, we'll play the classics here a little bit. Splash Mountain for Brook Lopez, to me, it's like, chef's kiss, giant dude who like moves like a mountain and hits a bunch of threes at a high volume. Splash Mountain and the Disney connection to it really, you know, can't be beat. It works from all sort of angles for me. We move from fill in the blank to one of our signature segments here. Really, it's taking the nation by storm. It's catching the world on fire. The closing five, because as you know, Chris Harrington, certified ball knower, Chris Harrington, how you start is not as important as how you finish. So we finish with five questions to learn a little bit more about you, Chris Harrington. Number one, in addition to your basketball coverage duties, you are also a wonderful culture critic who, again, has Twin Cities connections. So snap judgment. What's the best replacement song?
My personal favorite is I Will Dare off of Let It Be. It's hard to argue against Can't Hardly Wait, though. Those would be my two.
You're correct both ways. No arguments here. Although if we're going to do Can't Hardly Wait, it's got to be the Tim version, the demo version for me.
Shout out to my friend Bob Mayer, who was executive produced the Tim box set that came out this year.
Incredible stuff. I love that. Question number two. I know you are a parent. You have one kid, two kids?
Two.
Two kids. Ages?
My daughter is a freshman in college right now at DePaul University. Shout out Chicago. And my son is 13.
Okay, so mine are 9 and 6. So you are aging up ahead of me. My question was going to be like, what kind of kid content is most dominating your life now? But maybe not much dominating right now. What was the kid content that most dominated your life when they were younger, and how did you deal with it?
We had to have the Disney Channel so my son could watch all the Marvel movies, and he got into a Simpsons run, which was good to see. He's more into comics and video games these days, but I'm starting to make him read again. When my kids were little, I had a thing called family reading time where we would go to a coffee shop and we'd make everyone would bring a book and we would all read. So now that my son is drifting away from reading on his own, I'm making him read again. So we're doing father-son reading time now.
I love this. That's tremendous. And also, whenever you can use, I mean, if it's comic books, if it's graphic novels, if it's whatever, anything that gets them reading is a plus. We're saying yes to that. We're not judging. Is it the right kind of reading or not the right kind of reading? Get them reading. It doesn't matter what. This is also the podcast where the great Katie Heindel recommended as her weekly recommendation, going to the library. So we're firmly pro reading time in whatever context it comes here on Divine Intervention. Question three, who is the best quote you've covered in Memphis?
Oh, that's got to be Tony Allen, because he wouldn't even be in control of his quotes, you know. He wouldn't even understand what he was saying half the time. I mean, one of the famous Tony Allen phrases is milk that horse.
Tony, they don't do that. That's not the right animal.
If you do that,
you're going to get in trouble, actually.
Yeah. So Tony Allen's the all-timer. I mean, Tony Allen like accidentally came up with the whole like era of branding just by talking on the sidelines after a game. Like, all heart, grit, grind. That wasn't a marketing department. That's just Tony Allen talking after a game. So Tony Allen by far.
Incredible. Anytime we can shout out the grandfather on this show, it's a good day to me. This is a little esoteric, but go with me. Question number four. You only get to have one and the other oeuvre doesn't exist. Are you taking like 80s, early 90s broad comedy Bill Murray? Or are you taking Wes Anderson, Sofia Coppola, Jim Jarmusch Bill Murray? You only get to have one. You don't get to have the other.
I think I'm going to take the latter on that. I like that late period, Lost in Translation, Rushmore, especially. Rushmore is very dear to my heart. Bill Murray and Rushmore. I always laugh to bring it back to basketball, him blocking the little kids playing basketball.
The greatest rejection in film history, without question.
So, even some Broken Flowers, Bill Murray, to bring your Jim Jarmusch in. So I'm going to go with the later, the arty Bill Murray.
I feel like I'm going to have to bring this question back for a lot of people, because that is a big divide, man. Now we're walking away from Groundhog Day. We're walking away from Stripes. We're walking away from Ghostbusters. We're walking away from a whole lot of sort of integral stuff for people of a certain age. But I think, you might not be wrong. It's like, My love for the Wes Anderson version of this is giant. And as you mentioned, Rushmore, I felt my heart growing like the Grinch. So I might fall on that side of it too.
That's the tipping point for me on the question is Rushmore.
Much to be considered. I mean, Raleigh Sinclair and the Royal Tenenbaums, there's a lot to think about. I'm going to have to think deeply about this one now that I've forced you to do it. Question five. You also, among the many hats you wear at the Daily Memphian, you also cover the dining scene. Yes, you cover Food and Nights Out.
A little bit more lately, but yeah.
Okay. So if I reach out to you and say, hey, I'm coming to town for a homestand, I'm going to be around for a few games, where do I got to eat? Let's presume that you like me. Let's start from the presumption that you like me. Where are you sending me?
The place I find myself taking people a lot, just because who doesn't like pizza and beer? Some people don't drink beer, but that's fine. But pizza and beer are a classic combo. The best pizza in town is inside a brewery that's actually pretty close to FedEx Forum, the Wiseacre Brewery. There's a pizza stand inside called Little Betty. A great pizza beer combo. If you want barbecue in Memphis, I would send you to Cozy Corner or Payne's. If you want soul food, I can hook you up there. If you want fancy food, I can hook you up there. But the Little Betty Pizza and the Cozy Corner Barbecue Shop Barbecue would be my first choices.
I love all of that. And I love, if nothing else, the fact that listeners here are going to be realizing that they need to know Chris Harrington. That's what I want people to come away with. He can hook you up with the spots and you need to know that. We get out of here firmly and officially after the closing five with a weekly recommendation, which is actually something I stole from you when you invited me on the Daily Memphian Grizzlies podcast last year. I knew
that bit seemed familiar when I listened to some of the earlier pods. Yeah.
Listen, the great ones steal, and I intend to be a great one. So it can be anything. It does not have to be about basketball. It can be about anything. Previous, as I mentioned earlier, Katie Heindel recommended going to the library. Josh Gondelman recommended sending your friend who just had a kid a food delivery gift card. I have recommended making baked ziti and making weekend coffee. It can be anything. So, Chris Harrington, what is something that you would recommend to our listeners? This might make them a little bit happier and a little bit better, something cool and good for the people.
So you either chose depending on your perspective, the best or the worst time of the year that to ask me this, because I am still at least a part-time arts critic. And as a part-time arts critic, I'm very much in year-end list mode come December.
Yes.
So I'm going to, with your indulgence, I'm going to cheat and give you four quick recommendations from each of the four main corners of culture, at least as I consume it. So my movies pick, we'll start with that. My movies pick, my favorite movie of 2023 that is not ubiquitous on various year-end lists is Showing Up, a small film that came out early this year, the fourth collaboration of director Kelly Reichardt and actress Michelle Williams. Williams is a Portland sculptor preparing for a show while dealing with her day job and her family and her cat and her negligent landlord, who is also another artist who she resents for being more successful than her and also probably her best friend. And it's just this wry little movie about how we just navigate our day-to-day lives and our creative pursuits and our need to make money and all the other tensions in our life. I've seen it twice. I think about it all the time. It's maybe not for all tastes, but then again, what is? That's my movies pick. My music pick, my favorite album of 2023 is Rats All God by the North Carolina indie rock band Wednesday. As someone who grew up in sort of a working class, lower middle class environment in Eastern Arkansas, I feel like their evocation of a lower middle class, working class environment in Western North Carolina is spot on. It feels very familiar to me. They write very smart, very funny songs. They put them across with a sound, a rock sound that to me is sort of halfway between the Drive-By Truckers and Dinosaur Jr. It is very for me. I think that's my favorite album of the year.
That sounds tremendous. I will be listening to that after we get off the line here.
My television pick, and this could be my book pick, but I'll make it my television pick, is the series Slow Horses, which just wrapped up season 3 this week on Apple TV. It's a British spy series that's rooted in a series of novels by this Arthur McCarron. Every season is an adaptation of one book in the series. Each season is only 6 episodes long, so it's very tight. The plotting is great. The vibes and the characterization and the sense of place is even better. Gary Oldman stars. You can basically smell him through the screen. I love it.
Good, bad, indifferent. We'll see. But, I like that. Evocative.
And then my fourth pick, my books pick. My reading, unlike my listening and watching, is not rooted in things that are new. It's just whatever in the various stacks of books around my house I've bought over the years. What do I pick up 10 years later and actually read? And so for whatever reason, this week, this Christmas break, the thing I picked up, which I bought 15 years ago and I probably should have read in high school but never got around to, I've been reading In Cold Blood by Truman Capote.
Yeah.
Guess what? Shocking revelation. I've joined the hundreds of thousands of people who already know this book is hella great. It's elegant and gripping and like, man, he was on one. So shout out to Truman Capote.
I can't believe it's taken 2.5 months of making this show to get to shout out Truman Capote, but I am very glad that we got there on this episode. That is incredible. You not only understood the assignment, you blew the assignment out through the back wall of this place.
I was just waiting to get to this point. This is why I'm here.
That's right. It's all this boring Grizzlies talk. Yeah, let's get to the point where we recommend pop culture stuff to one another. That is absolutely lights out. Thank you so much for that, Chris. Mine is, I don't know why this is, but it struck me and I listened to it again a couple times this week and I'm going to it. It is Paul F. Tompkins, a stand-up comedian, his bit about peanut brittle. And you can hear it anywhere I'm guessing wherever you're listening to this. If you're seeing us on YouTube, listening to us on whatever podcast platform of choice, it is on his 2007 album, Impersonal. And it is, so anywhere you're streaming records, you could find that, or again on YouTube. And it is a premise drenched in irony, which is, what if we treated the fact that you could still go into a novelty shop and find a gag can marked peanut brittle, but that has springs inside and pops out and scares you? What if that we just treated that as a completely normal thing? And then the speaker is like someone who has been taken in by the prank, and it just builds and builds and builds, and act outs and really overwrought character work and obsessive commitment to just making every word choice as silly and stupid as possible. It is a 5.5 minute chunk based brought out of this premise. And it's like, that is what like a comedian at the peak of his craft, controlling an audience, bringing everybody along with this thing and executing a premise that is like, doesn't make any sense and doesn't seem like it should work, but for 5.5 minutes, and it's getting laugh after laugh after laugh. The stand-up comedian John Roy wrote about it for Vulture a few years back, and he said, talk show bookers tell you to get your first laugh by the 40-second mark of your set. Paul gets his in 6 seconds. The only way to get one faster is to fall into a pie. I can't recommend it enough. I think it's wonderful. And if you really are into it, there is a phenomenal podcast. Jesse David Fox, who's a culture editor at Vulture and comedy critic, interviewed Paul F. Tompkins about this on his podcast, Good One. They break it down in obsessive detail and talk about Paul F. Tompkins' career and his approach to comedy. It was one of the best things I listened to in all of 2023, that episode of Good One. And the bit is also one of the best things I've ever listened to. So one of my favorite things in the world is when smart people put a lot of work into making something dumb. And this is that. And so if you like that too, I think you will like this. And I think you will like everything that Chris Harrington does across the various areas of his expertise and coverage. Chris, where can people find your work? Is there anywhere else you'd like to point people to on the way out the door? Let the people get more of Chris Harrington.
I write for the Daily Memphian, which is a sort of one of the canaries in the coal mine of nonprofit internet newspapers. One of the people who left the Daily traditional Daily in town to help start that up. You can find me there at dailymythian.com. If you're on social media, like on X or Twitter or whatever, I'm just at Chris Harrington. I'm also on Threads, but I can't remember like what my handle is on that, but I'm sure you could find me.
Yeah, we're all trying to figure out which of the boats to get into and how much to put into the boats. And it's Not sure about that. Whatever boat you are trying to get into, folks, Liz, if you're following basketball, if you are looking for coverage of the Memphis Grizzlies, you do owe it to yourself to follow Chris's coverage. And I am a subscriber to the Daily Memphian largely because of Chris Harrington's coverage, even though I don't live there. So I can put my money where my mouth is, and I can say it is some of the best coverage of any team you'll get anywhere. And I heartily recommend that. That's going to do it for this episode of Divine Intervention. I want to thank Chris Harrington for taking all this time to be with us and also to reconnect with himself. Let's be honest. I want to say thank you to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. And a special thank you to the folks at HUDCO in Dobbs Ferry, New York, co-working space that is hosting me. We're not at the apartment studio in Brooklyn. We are out of town for the holiday weekend with family. And so they graciously have allowed me to rent space here, but they're putting me up for the week. So thanks so much to HUDCO for that. If you have the opportunity to, take a moment, rate us, review us, 5 stars always helps with discoverability and growing the show on whichever platform you are getting us. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you again next week. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.